Whenever I hear Edward Phillips playing his resonator slide guitar, I get hungry for low country cooking. If you want to hear more of Edward's Delta Blues, go to his YouTube channel. Just type in at Edward Phillips Roots. That's at Edward Phillips Roots. So sit back and relax. We're coming up with Cornbread and Buttermilk's podcast. For now, enjoy Edward's slide guitar.
Hey, Cornbread.
Welcome to the Cornbread and Buttermilk Podcast. We are podcasting from the Southern Appalachian foothills from the Brook Park Studio in the beautiful city of Canton, Georgia. The Cornbread and Buttermilk Podcast is where we discuss the culinary uniqueness of the Deep South. Our mission is to explore the culinary origins of the Southern kitchen while sharing our passions for recipes from the Southern agrarian past. We bring stories, recipes, book reviews, and tips from the kitchen gardener. Hello, and welcome to the Cornbread and Buttermilk Podcast, where we discuss Southern culinary stories from the past. And I'm Cornbread, and this is Buttermilk sitting here with me.
Hey, Cornbread.
How you been doing this week? You've been doing a lot of research, and we had a fascinating
field trip. We did. Yeah. For those of you who don't know, we aren't able to take many weekend field trips, and so this last weekend we were able to get away to the Hardman Farm and attend the Cows Come Home celebration, and along with that, we went to Nora Mills, which is a very authentic granary on the Chattahoochee River. And we'll get into all that, but it was fun. We had a really good time and learned a lot. Got to meet a lot of interesting people.
Yeah, we certainly did. It was the Hardman Farm. I was really looking forward to that trip because when you tell me about it, we looked it up and kind of read a little bit about what was going to be going on there. I was really excited about getting a chance to tour some of those old, the dairy barn for one, and the original house that was built by Captain Nichols.
Well, anybody who's been to Helen knows about the Indian Mound, there's a huge, huge pasture with a very unique, you were telling me it's 40 feet high, the Indian Mound itself, and then there's a huge gazebo mm-hmm. on top of it that the second owner built. And anybody who's
it was built by the first owner.
Oh, it was built by Nichols?
Nichols
okay.
built it, yeah.
Well, anybody who's been to Helen through by that way, it's sort of at an intersection of sorts, and that field is part of the Hardman estate, part of the farm. It's a huge farm. How many acres?
I think it was over 300 acres.
Yeah. And it was a dairy farm.
Yeah, it was actually 300, seemed like it said 360 acres, but that was what was turned over to the state Natural Resources Department for
right.
management
right.
from the Hardman family.
So it's considered a historic site?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's it was turned over to them. I was a little puzzled. I was looking at a map earlier today of that area because I've been going up there for 50 years. I've camped at Unicoi State Park. I've fished rivers around there and we've both gone up there and fished in Smith Creek, and we've been to Anarubi Falls many times, hiking up the trail to
sure.
it. But I never connected a lot of that all together because it seemed like it was you drove from this point to that point. But if you look at it from a map, And I could see where that was at one time probably all connected. And I think where the Anarubi Falls is, that state park.
Yeah.
You know, and part of it's a federal park.
Right.
I think that all belonged to Nichols at one time.
Well, there's Unicoi and then there's Anarubi.
Yeah. Well, the falls was named after Nichols' daughter, Anarubi.
Right.
Nichols.
Right.
And him and her used to explore all that land up there as he was buying it up.
Yeah.
He was, as I understand, after the Civil War, he was at a sort of a health center in Gainesville that had sulfur springs.
Right. He had malaria after the Civil War, and so he felt like that would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. And so while he was there, I guess he got the feeling better, and I'm sure he met other people there, and they were telling him about the Nacoochee Valley is what everyone refers to this as. But it's kind of funny, as I started reading into the history of it, back then he just referred to it as the West End. It was the West End of that valley in there.
Which is no relation to West End, Atlanta.
when I first heard it that he developed West End, I thought he was talking about the West End in Atlanta.
So. Yeah.
But no, it's the West End is that region right there that now they call the Saltine-Nacoochee Valley.
And that the farm itself is just, you know, the weather wasn't perfect. It wasn't a bright sunny day, but it wasn't raining. There had been a lot of rain the day before, and so the pastures and the grounds were a little muddy, but there was a good turnout, and they have a lot of docents, a lot of people there to help give you information about the owners, and you can't tour the upstairs, and some of the rooms are roped off, but you can look in, you can walk into the house, and they have people there in period costume to greet you and kind of tell you about the property and the house and the various features. And it was just great. There was, then you can tour, like you said, the dairy barn, which was very unique for its time.
Yeah. And actually that barn was built at a later date.
Oh, darn it.
Well, it was built by the Hardmans.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why don't I just let you tell it?
No, that's fine. It is a little confusing. There were actually three owners. They Nichols built the house and collected the land together and actually owned. Now, when you start talking to people and getting stories, then you go back and you're looking up this history, it gets a little muddy because
well, that's what we were saying. The docents, it's not really a guided tour,
right?
And
right.
So they're talking to people as they come in, and you're signing a guest book, and they're telling you, you know, what they know or what they've heard, but it's not guided. And so there was a certain amount of information that obviously I've gotten wrong.
It was a little confusing. And if you looked at all of it, it all looked like it could have very well been built at the same time. They're very similarity. But the dairy barn was built. That was something added by the Hardemans. They wanted to produce butter, is the way I understood it. And it was a creamery. And they used Jersey cows because they produce a richer fat content milk.
Okay, because now they have
Holsteins out there,
which actually have a higher butter fat content, don't they? I mean,
we'll be back after a quick break.
Our friends at Farm Fresh Beef are having a spring sale on their sides of beef and pork. Cornbread and Buttermilk love their steaks and bacon. Farm Fresh Beef is raised in the USA and Ellijay, Georgia, without hormones or antibiotics, and their steaks are the best I've ever had. Their applewood and hickory smoked bacon will make your mouth water, and that's a guarantee right there. So, call Robin Solomon with any questions you might have at 770-781-4563. That's Robin Solomon, and her number again is 770-781-4563. And that's at Farm Fresh Beef. And they're in Ball Ground, Georgia. Holstein, they produce more milk.
Okay, that's what it is. Yeah,
they produce more milk. That's why so many farmers, I think, have gone to Holstein's. Is that they produce more milk, but the
Hardmans wanted to produce cream.
Yeah. So and that's the thing is,
and we're all for that.
I've had Holsteins before. I used to buy the calves from the dairyman, because they didn't want bull calves.
Right.
So I'd get the bull calves and raise them out for beef. But the Holsteins, people like them because they had a big bag of udders and they could produce lots of milk. So one cow could produce probably twice as much milk volume as a Jersey cow, but the butter fat was lower.
So when he first built the dairy, he had how many was it they could milk at a time, and they milked them twice a day.
Yeah, was it 75?
Something. It was a shocking number because they really weren't using milking machines to start with.
I heard so much information there. It's honestly hard to keep it all up, and I wasn't writing it down. It is a huge barn. As a matter of fact, I put some pictures of it on my Instagram account.
Yeah.
And you can see the length of it on there if you pull that up on WCKN or Western CKN. The other interesting thing was, like I said, Anna Ruby ended up being the only child of James and Kate Nichols.
Two or three that died in infancy.
Yeah, they had two sons that died in infancy, and she survived into, I think she died, she was 92 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, I think she lived until 1947, I think.
Yeah.
Or maybe, yeah, I think it was 47. I mean, you could imagine he came home from the war, and his wife was, had never really recovered. Their home was ransacked. And so when he returned back to Milledgeville, where their home was outside of Milledgeville in Midway, he just packed up everybody and left. And I guess that's when he went to Gainesville. And that's one of the reasons why he decided to make a home up there, because it was
Peaceful,
yeah.
Good for her, good for him.
Yeah, and so she stayed in the upstairs part of the house, and her mother and they had a servant that helped her mother tend to her. And I suppose it was after her mother's death that they ended up committing her, I think in 1890, to the Mental Institute in Milledgeville. But yeah, you could tell he probably doted over Anna Ruby, because when they discovered the falls on over at the top of Smith Creek, he named the falls Anna Ruby.
Yeah.
Over, after her. And I think there was, I remember back when I used to go up Smith Creek and up to Anna Ruby, and I heard about Anna Ruby Falls. Mm-hmm. I may have asked someone why they call it Anna Ruby Falls. Apparently there was, they logged the top of the mountain back then, because that was the business up there was lumber.
Right. Yes.
And he logged the top of the mountain, and then they sent the logs down the, I think they must have had like a flue-like situation where they would put the log in and come down, or possibly the water was up high enough that it would just float the logs down. But it's a pretty rapid, a lot of rapids going out there, a lot of stones.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the main business that that he had up there, was a lumber, and then I think he bought that the Nora Mills from that Mr. I think it was Mr. Mitchell, who had come up there to mine for gold and had built them, ended up building the grist mill.
Yeah,
it was really interesting. Like I said, I started kind of connecting dots that I'd seen all my life in my visits up there. There's an area over there that you and I both have gone through that I've always been fascinated with, called Bean Creek.
Bean Creek.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the people that lived at Bean Creek possibly worked for him. I think one of the docents had told me that people at Bean Creek would come work at the dairy. That was for Mr. Hardman.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. Well, and they walked. There's a path that goes behind the farm. Actually, when we were at Nora Mills, you could mm-hmm. see across the river, across the mill to where people were hiking over there. But apparently that was the road, probably the yeah. road yeah. that people used, yeah. The workers used to get to the farm.
Yeah. When I looked at a map, because you and I both have gone up there and driven down Bing Creek. And,
oh, yeah.
And
we just like to say it.
Yeah, Bing Creek is just a very natural-looking place yeah, with the little waterfalls here and there and a creek, Bing Creek. And,
lots of trout.
Lots of trout, we would assume, was in those creeks. But when I looked at the map, you can see very easily how people could have walked through the woods or even rode a mule through the woods over oh, yeah. to the dairy and the farm itself. But, yeah, it was interesting to see how everything kind of connected together when I was looking at the map. And the Nora Mill, which you think, yeah, we get in a car and we drove around out yeah. of the parking lot and mm-hmm. come back up the main road and into Helen almost to Helen before you get to Nora Mills. But when I got to Nora Mills, I looked at it on the map. There again, you could have, that little path
it's an
you
easy
said.
Walking
yeah,
path.
You could have
yeah.
walked across there. Yeah. yeah. I was thinking that I was telling Buttermilk, I would almost believe that may have been the road, that trail.
It could have been, yeah, the main road.
Yeah, the main road, because, you know, I mean, we drive the paved roads and the roads that,
yeah.
But what we've experienced, even up here, and the farm that we had was, you know, we're talking to people, and I said, well, the road wasn't there back when I was growing yeah, up, the road yeah. was over here. They show us,
yeah.
and then you go to dig something up, and then suddenly you realize you're hitting all this gravel and everything.
Yeah.
And you say, man, this road, I mean, this dirt is just full of gravel. And they say, oh, yeah, well, the road came through here. And
yeah.
then, you know, it's a dirt yeah. gravel road.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, a lot of times these roads, you know, originally were a little bit of one way or the other, but then, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the... the gazebo, and that, I heard two different stories, and I don't know which one is the most accurate. I don't know if you'd ever know, but, well, I guess it would be something you could find out if you were had the tools to do it. But I read one story where they said the Indian mound is 190 feet long and 40 feet tall. And,
yeah.
And I read another one that said 190 feet long and 20 feet tall.
It's hard to say, you know, because it's out there in the middle of the pasture, and it's not really accessible. I mean, it's fenced in, and the cows were out there. It's not, there's nowhere to park. It's not like you can just hike out there.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say, but it's definitely visible.
Oh, yeah.
You can't miss it.
Yeah, it's a landmark. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the gazebo is on top of it. Captain Nichols had it built when he had the house built. So he was, according to one of the stories I read, that he liked to go up there and just sit.
Well, yeah, you can imagine. I mean, you'd have just a great view of all that you had built.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, well, he could watch construction from up there. But,
yeah.
One of the park rangers said that he said he had been up there. He said the view was really quite phenomenal.
Well, it would be different. I mean, after all these years of driving past it and just looking at it, to be on top of it would really be something.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And the building of that place, you know, because there's a lot of outbuildings out there. There's a carriage house.
Oh, yeah.
There's a carriage house. There's a horse barn.
Yeah.
There was there's the kitchen. It's like we had talked about before. I think we had mentioned when we were talking about the hush puppies that the kitchen on a lot of those houses were separate buildings because the kitchens were the first thing to catch on fire.
Yeah. So well, and in the summer, it would be so hot.
Right, right.
Without air conditioning to be cooking within the house. So they had a breezeway connecting the kitchen with the... And all of these buildings are just... we were just dazzled, honestly, with all of the ornate outdoor moldings. And
1869 was when he started the house, and it was completed by 1870. There weren't any power tools.
Right.
So they were sawing the stuff, the scroll work that was on this house.
It's just elaborate.
Very elaborate. And even on the barn. The barn wasn't that. The barn wasn't there. This dairy barn wasn't.
Right.
But there were other barns.
Yeah.
There were buildings for that. Well, there was a. What was it? It was a smokehouse.
Yeah, there was a smokehouse. There was an attached, living quarters, small living quarters next to that.
Mm-hmm.
But all the outbuildings were architecturally similar. I mean, they had created all of this working farm to have the same architectural footprint.
Yeah.
And like you said, I mean, it was just elaborate. But you have to figure these were men that had either been to war, were coming home from war, and needed work.
Right.
But
there were some talented people up there, too. Very talented.
Very talented.
I mean, the work in this house, well, the staircase, for example, is solid walnut.
Right, black walnut.
Black walnut, sawn on the property itself.
A lot of it was hand-milled there on the property.
And the front doors were also black walnut.
Right. And heart of pine flooring throughout and just in indoor plumbing, or was that something Hardman? That was something Hardman.
I'm honestly not sure. I think that maybe Nichols put that in there.
Wow.
Because they said that they were working on the, there's a small outbuilding that was a tack room.
Oh, okay.
And somehow or another, somebody was working on it or doing whatever, but they found out that there was a cistern, a water cistern underneath it that was 8 feet deep.
Yeah.
And they said they believed that it was to be able to supply the horses with water.
Right.
And then there was that creek that ran right beside the house through.
Oh, through so the, beautiful.
Yeah, and I never understood exactly what it was. They called it the gas house, and it.
Yeah, I didn't fully. I think I wandered off at that point. I'm not sure what that was.
The docent I was talking to said they weren't quite clear because the equipment was gone, and they didn't know if it was like. Kerosene run, and I don't know exactly what it did, unless it was maybe.
Well, didn't they donate it during World War One?
World War Two.
World War
One.
Two.
Yeah, one or two. I can't remember.
One or two.
Yeah. Somehow or another it was donated, and I guess never came back.
There was a lot of farm equipment, like mystery farm equipment that we said you took a lot of pictures. You said we'd have to ask Dan Hester what this does, because honestly, the upkeep on a farm like this that's really not working today would be, it's a historical site, and it would just be tremendous to keep all of this up. And there was not someone outside who could really tell us what any of those things were. Yeah, lots of outbuildings, lots of farm equipment that,
Yeah. Yeah, like I was saying, that had the smokehouse. They had a brick grated smoker in the middle where they would build a fire and smoke. They had simulated ham and sausages hanging from the ceiling, to kind of show you what it would have looked like. And in a separate room next to the smokehouse was some of the servants or helpers to work to stay in. And kitchen, we went into kitchen. They were making cookies in a wood burning stove. And that was really fascinating. One of the docents, they were dressed in period costumes, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a fire going in the wood stove. And it really smelled good.
Yeah, it was warm in there. Yeah. Well, so, and they have throughout the year, for whatever reason, I thought this cow's come home celebration was the only thing they had. But they have events and different kinds of festivals. They have, when we were there, they actually had lots of people with crafts.
Yeah.
Along the walkway, had booths, people mm-hmm. that make different things. There was artwork. There were some outdoor musicians. There was outdoor barbecue. But throughout the year, they have, I think they have actually have an Easter egg hunt on the grounds.
Yeah, I did see something about the same lady that was making the cookies. And,
yes.
And she was making, it was interesting, she was making homemade colors for the eggs.
Yeah.
Using turmeric and onion and beet juice.
Yeah. So they do that, and they do, they have something for, you know, Memorial Day and then for the 4th of July. And then their biggest event, or one of the biggest, for the first three weekends in December, they have Christmas at Hardman Farms.
Yeah.
What do they call it? Christmas? Just the Christmas festival?
Oh, a Victorian Christmas.
A Victorian Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah. And everyone we've talked to went on and on about that. Mm-hmm. But you can find a listing for the events at the Department of Natural Resources, dnr.gov. /Georgia. Yeah.
https
:// Yeah. Or you can just type in Hardman Farm.
Right, yeah.
And it'll pop up, and it's worthwhile. I mean, there was a lot of history, but it was just a lot of people, you know, wanting to share what they knew, and a lot of history. It's really amazing that property is there, and well worth your attention.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it's being well cared for. It looks like. Well, I tell you, you have to hand it to the Hardman family. They only turned that over to the state in, I think, 1998 or something
right.
like that.
Right, which is remarkable.
And they kept it up until then.
Yeah,
and I'm sure it was quite an expense to maintain, because they didn't live there.
Right, Lamartine.
Lamartine Griffin Hardman, and he was the governor of the state of Georgia from 1927 to 1931.
Yeah.
And he served in the House of Representatives before that and after that.
So yeah.
He was very active in the politics in the state of Georgia and did a lot of really worthwhile things. He was a practicing physician himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a great fan of Crawford Long, who developed anesthesia so that, you know, they could operate on you without you having to hold a stick, gnawing a stick in your mouth while they sawed your leg off or something. But,
oh, Lord.
but yeah, you know, at that time he was very fascinated by the whole thought of anesthesia and surgery and anesthesia. And so he studied everything that Crawford Long was doing. I'm sure that there was lots of the information was out there, and Crawford Long shared it with people. And so
so how many years is that? I mean, they had it from, didn't we figure it was like 160 years?
Hardman bought it in, I think, 1907, was it? Let's see, it was the Nichols owned it. And I think they sold it to Mr. Honeycutt.
Oh, that's right. There was an in-between owner that nobody mentioned, so Mr. Honeycutt must not have distinguished himself in any way.
He was a busy guy. He was I think he bought it as an investment probably and just saw the value of the place. He had his hands full. He started out as, like, I thought, in maybe as a haberdasher, working in a haberdashery in Cartersville, and then distinguished himself there and actually opened a clothing store. And then maybe he ended up in the plumbing business, but I think it was more or less he owned and sold plumbing components so that people could plumb their homes in Atlanta. Then he ended up owning either part of or all of the Atlanta Stove Company.
Mm.
So, I mean, he was, you know, busy guy.
This place was a hobby farm.
Yeah, he probably bought it for a hobby farm and never had time to go up there.
much less take care of it.
Practice his hobby. But, so the Hardmans bought it from him. It was interesting. He had also, I think another connection was that he had also and had served in the Confederacy. So I'm sure there was a connection there between him and Nichols. Now, Hardman was, I mean, he was a child.
Different generation,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, different generation, so he wasn't really involved in any of that. But
now, who was Nora? Where did the name Nora come from for Nora Mills?
Nora was...
because the... Is it Granary? Is that how
you... Yeah,
okay, Granary. The Granary was all... Was part of the farm.
Yeah, that was Hardman's sister.
Okay.
He named...
That's where it came from.
Her name was Nora, and she had passed away, and in her memory, he named the mill for her. And I'm not sure what year that was.
Yeah.
But that was the way I understood it.
And that's another landmark. I mean, if you're familiar with that area, there's a... It's not so much a waterfall as it is a dam, I guess.
Yeah. It's they
it's a grist mill. Yeah.
They got a little. It's like a dammed up area of the Chattahoochee River.
Yeah.
And they divert part of that flow off the dam around through a channel, and underneath the mill. And there's a what do you call it? It's not a turbine. It's a pin turbine. It's not like a water wheel.
Yeah.
But it's more like a turbine, and they divert the water down through the turbine.
Yeah.
That turns those big stones.
These stones are massive, and they came from France in the 1700s? Yeah. 1800? We don't know when they came from.
Yeah, I would imagine they cut. Yeah, it would have been 1800. It was built by a man named Martin.
Okay.
In 18... I'm not really sure if...
But it's still a working mill. Yeah. I mean, they have a tremendous... They have a general store, but they also, I think, do demonstrations, and they were not milling while we were there, but you could see the stones and kind of get a feel for, you know, how the whole thing works. And you could walk out through the back of the building onto the... there's a walkway along the... Chattahoochee, so you could see how it worked. But they have everything from cornbread, cornbread mix, and they have every kind of pancake and waffle mix you can imagine. Just anything you can mill, grits, oats.
I asked the guy. I said, "Well, what's the difference between milling cornmeal and milling grits?" And he said, "It's the grits are." Not as fine as the cornmeal. The cornmeal's finer. And, of course, the flour is even finer than that.
But, yeah.
But they can adjust the millstones up and down for a finer or coarser grind.
It looks archaic. I mean, when you look at it, it looks just like you would expect these huge round
stones. Yeah, I imagine it looks like it looked 150 years ago when they built it.
Yeah. I mean, it must have been quite an undertaking, and made the lives of a lot of people much easier, I guess.
Yeah, they had the millstones. They referred to them as French burrs, and
that's B-U-R-R-S?
B-U-R-R. Well, I think it's just no S to it. I think it's just French burr stones.
Oh, okay.
But they, I looked them up. I was curious what a French burr stone was. I figured it came from France, and I was right.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, of course, the way they were, I couldn't really see the face of the stones that are the working stones.
No.
From what I read, French burr stones were made up of separate pieces that were put together like a jigsaw puzzle, and then there was a band, a steel iron band that went around the outside that held it all together.
Huh.
And these things weighed average 1,500 pounds each.
Yeah.
And you've got an upper and you've got a lower.
Right.
And the lower one stays stationary, and the upper one's the one that turns.
It does the grinding.
Yeah, it's on like an axle or a spindle that goes up through the hole in the center of the two.
Right.
And in the top one, then it goes down into the pinwheel turbine, which is down underneath the floor. That's the water that turns. It turns the upper one, and there's lots of levers and things around there.
Yeah, it's archaic looking. I mean, but it's, you know, given the they do all this right there in the granary, and package it And
and this stone is they called it a quartz crystal stone.
Oh,
it's,
wow.
It's it's very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And after reading how they were made in France back in the 1800s by hand, with a little hand pick, they were saying that a man worked for 10 hours on a shift, and they didn't live much beyond 34 years old.
Oh, that's right. That's because of all the silica dust.
Yeah, the silica dust from that.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah,
and of course, there's always a risk of one of them turning over or falling on you from moving them around and breaking
adjusting
a leg.
Adjusting them, yeah. There's just no end to the
to the
ways to die around those things.
Yeah, once you got them completed, they had to be shipped to the United States. I guess they were sold all over the world because they were that famous for their stones or millstones. And just think
that it's lasted all these years.
They're still using it. Yeah,
that's remarkable.
They have rebuilt, they said, the pinwheel turbine that turns it.
Well, just seeing the dam is amazing. I mean, we had had a lot of rain last week, and the water was just thundering over that. So I can imagine.
Yeah, and I know there had to have been rainbow trout in there.
Oh, yeah, there had to have been. But they have a lot of signs that say no fishing
All the products they produce, I mean, they had a number of...
it was shocking. Yeah. I mean, just incredible the number of products that they have.
Yeah, yeah. Flour, cornmeal, grits.
Yellow cornmeal, white cornmeal.
And they even have some already prepared so that you can just mix it up without having to...
Right.
Measure
mixes,
out.
Yeah. Pancakes, waffles, mm-hmm. muffins, all that.
Yeah. You probably just take that pancake mix that they had there and the biscuit mix too, I guess.
Biscuits. Yeah.
Pour some milk in there with it, stir it up, and voila, you got a biscuit. Voila, you got a pancake.
Cornbread.
Cornbread, right. Yeah.
They had everything but buttermilk.
Yeah. Yeah. Lodge skillets.
Yeah, they had a general store. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, as far as just walking in and seeing the stones and seeing, they do demonstrations of the actual milling, but really smart of them to add a general store where you can purchase all these things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of funny. I asked one of the guys working, and this owner's now...
This is third generation.
Third generation, right, that they've owned it. They bought it from the Hardman family, I think.
I think that young man that you were talking to, I'm guessing, I think he was, seemed to be in charge that day and seemed mm-hmm. to be, yeah. sounded like he knew a lot about the business.
Yeah, his mother, I guess, had taken over from his grandfather when his grandfather bought it and restored it. And,
yeah.
And started milling. His daughter, that boy's mother, had worked right there with him and kind of left the business too. And so after her father died, she ran it. And now her three children, I think I was her son, and that girl, one of the girls there, was his wife.
Well, I mean, they're very helpful and nice.
Oh, yeah.
They're respectful, nice kids.
Yeah, I asked him about... I was growing up, my father introduced me to this guy one time, and everybody was kind of like, Renner kept calling him Hollywood, and my dad introduced me to him. I can't remember what his real name is right now, but he
doesn't matter. Yeah, when your name is Hollywood.
Yeah, when your name is Hollywood, that's all that matters. But he had been a child, and he lived up there near the Coochie Valley, or in the Coochie Valley, and he was watching the people from Hollywood came up there and were shooting a film with Susan Hayward.
Uh-huh.
And it was called I'd Climb the Highest Mountain.
Yeah.
And one of the scenes was, it was supposed to have been, her husband was a preacher, and she had seen this little boy and said, how about coming with us? We're having a church picnic. And his parents said, no, you don't need to go down there. He's got chores to do. And, we don't have time to go and watch over him. So she said, well, I'll watch over him. So anyway, the little boy that they picked up and used him, I guess, as an extra, he ends up going down to the – they used him as the part of the story that was a child who goes on a picnic, and he's with the preacher and the preacher's wife, and the boy drowns in the river.
And so that was Hollywood.
That was his part.
Okay, yeah.
And so as far as I know, he never was in any more movies, but he was.
Well, it's because he died.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he couldn't bring him back. But I asked the boy about it, and he just kind of like pointed back. They had a poster. Yeah, from the movie. That movie was probably in. From the 50s, I guess.
Oh, okay.
It was black and white, if I remember right.
Yeah.
I remember seeing the movie a couple of times.
Well, did you look it up on YouTube or
anything? No, I hadn't had a chance to look it up, but I can't remember who else would have been in it. I know Susan Hayward was in it, and she was the big a big star back then. It was interesting going through there, and we did... one other thing that we did while we were there, and we talked about honey last week, and they had a big exhibit of one of the local apiary. Is that how you say it? Apiary?
I think so. Apiary. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fancy word for beekeeping.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things we learned was that sourwood honey, mentioning this last week, I went through all these different kinds of honey, and actually sourwood honey is considered the quintessential Southern Mountain honey. It's actually considered the Gucci of honey, you know. So if you're looking for your Birkin bag of honey, that would be sourwood. And so we bought some. They had it there at Nora Mills. And so we bought some of that and some of the wildwood flower honey. And this week we tried the sourwood honey several times. And the description that we have is so perfect. It's really true. It's got a caramel. The first flavor when you, like, just on a spoon, we've had it on bread several times, toasted bread, but... if you just take a spoonful of it, you get a caramel flavor followed by a subtle, it's kind of a spicy floral flavor. You get hints of cinnamon and cloves. It's almost like a gingerbread flavor at the end. And the other interesting thing about sourwood honey is that it contains the highest phenolic content. Even higher than, I mean, and this is all, not that it's a better honey, but it is interesting, even higher phenolic content than Manuka honey, which is a very famous honey I talked about last week, I think from New Zealand. we know that phenols have tremendous antioxidant properties, so sourwood honey is especially good for that. You know, its antioxidant properties. And it's just delicious. I mean,
it's so delicious.
Just on a spoon. I mean, you know, it just, I said we were going to have to start marking the outside of the jar because it's really tempting to go in there and just take a swig.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's I've just kind of non-discriminately bought honey at the
grocery store. I know, I'm so
ashamed
that I've done that. I mean, not ashamed, but just, you know, just no real concept of all these different kinds and what all is involved. And like I said last week, it's a lot like wine in terms of the different flavors.
Once you taste the good stuff, you know.
Yeah, go back, right?
That was we hadn't opened the wildflower yet. I'm sure it's good too, though. But man, that the sour was good. I meant to look up. I wanted to see what a sour wood tree looked like.
Yeah, I really have no idea, but it's they must be pretty prolific.
Right. Yeah. You know, and I've been checking on our walks when we go on walks, and we've got a lot of Bradford pear trees, which are a decorative pear. They don't bear any fruit, I've been expecting to look up, and they're blooming this week really heavy.
Oh yeah.
And I thought, well, I'm going to look and see if there's any bees up there in those trees, and I haven't seen the first bee in them, and you know, these Bradford pears really have kind of a rank smell to them to me. I don't particularly care the way they smell.
They are pretty. They're one of the first, you know, trees to bloom, and they're white. There are a couple of different kinds, but no, they're completely ornamental, so the honeybees aren't really interested.
Yeah, which is disappointing. Yeah, I had, you know, it's interesting. I got a bush up here next to the house, and I don't even know what it is. It was here when we moved in, bought the house, but it has some sort of little tassel, like bloom blossom on it. And when it's in bloom, I mean, it is covered up with honeybees.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where is it? You mean down at the bottom of the driveway?
No, it's by the waterfall over next to between the house and the garage.
Oh, okay. I know what you mean. Yeah. Yeah, it does have a lot of blossoms.
Yeah, those little white nodule-looking things on it. Yeah. It's a funny-looking bloom, and I say, it looks kind of tropical-looking.
Yeah.
But, man, the bees love that. And they're just, like, all over it.
How about that?
And there'll be honeybees and those bumblebees.
Yeah. Interesting.
But
I was going to mention there are a lot, not a lot, but it surprised me how many southern bee companies there were. I guess as you said, it's apiaries. And you can buy from most of these online. They also have freestanding stores in a lot of cities. There's the Savannah Bee Company. I think we mentioned that last week where they have great gift crates. You can send out. We did that one Christmas. And they also, a lot of these companies use their honey like in beauty products and soaps and lotions and different, you know.
What was that you were telling me about earlier? Something where they'll start you off in beekeeping for free.
Yeah, that's it's called the Appalachian Beekeeping Collective, and they're online at abchoney.org. They've only been around since 2016, so 8 years.
Wow.
They are a nonprofit that trains, supports, and supplies both bees and equipment free of charge to what they call partner beekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
Since 2020 alone, they've planted over 300,000 trees, which I'm guessing would be to attract honeybees.
Yeah.
They've donated 800 hives spread across 100 partners. And I really didn't get into the website deeply enough to see how you do it, but I'm guessing you get in touch with them. And, you know, I'm sure there's forms to fill out, and maybe, you know, you can make a donation even if you're not interested in having your own bees. They also extract, bottle, market, and distribute Appalachian honey under the name ABC Honey on behalf of their member beekeepers. And they have a lot of fun pictures online. They do a lot of things with kids. They have a 3-week camp that I encouraged Cornbread to participate in. It's in June. it's called Camp Waldo.
I think you just want to get rid of me for 3 weeks.
It's not true. I'm not sure why it's called Camp Waldo, but a 3-week camp where you can, you know, I'm guessing learn everything you ever wanted to know about beekeeping. And
yeah. Yeah, you were showing me some photographs. It looked like I had some kids in there, and they were teaching them.
Yeah, it's a great thing. It's really – there's some other ones. There's Smiley Honey, which I had never heard of,
mm-hmm.
and one called Honey Next Door, which I liked.
Yeah.
In Tennessee, there's one called Old Mill Honey Company, and then there's the Asheville Bee Charmer, which is kind of fun.
You know, when you get to, looking at, I guess you got me interested in, I spent a lot of time in the last week, after we came back from the Hardman Farms and had our honey, and we tried out the sourwood honey, and started looking at, I thought, I wonder just, how much does it cost to to buy a beehive, you know, and everything. So I was looking on eBay and
yeah.
Oh boy, there's just tons of.
Yeah, well, let me tell you right now, it would cost you your marriage. Because I am not interested in raising bees.
Well, you might be. You might change your mind.
You know, well, yeah, and you might go to Camp Walton. See if that's something you really want to do.
It's probably something that's better just to be an armchair beekeeper than actually yeah. have to go out there in the rain and the snow and check on them. You
know? Yeah, it is fascinating and it is important. I mean, certainly it's good to see that there are lots of Southerners interested in keeping up with that tradition and keeping up with the willing to do that homework to get started in beekeeping. And well, it's a lot like farming. I mean, I think there are some years that are very disappointing. And I think I said last week that I was really fascinated by it because there's a queen involved.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because you have to have a queen, you know. Well, and she...
You've always been fascinated with the royalty.
Right? That's me, yeah. And, that reminds me, these companies also have... a lot of them sell royal jelly, which is what they feed the queen. They have bee pollen, which has all sorts of health properties, healing properties, good for people that suffer from allergies. Along with the, now the honey that we bought, we didn't get any with the comb in it.
No.
But you can actually eat the comb, which seems like I'd like to try that.
Yeah.
I would. I'd like to. It seems like it'd be crunchy and sweet. And
I remember when I was a kid, we used to buy the honey and have a piece of the comb in the jar.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And I remember getting it out and chewing it.
Yeah. It's real chewy, I guess.
Yeah.
Kind of waxy. Do you swallow it?
I can't remember if I did or not. I probably did.
You probably did.
yeah, it's fascinating when you start reading about. Well, it's not just the beekeeping itself; it's the importance of bees to pollinating all the plants
absolutely.
That we have. You know,
I think the key thing to remember is that when the bees go, we go. You know, they're responsible right. for pollinating 70% of the food we eat.
And they do a very important job for us, and without them, we wouldn't have enough food on the planet to feed everybody. But the other thing I wanted to mention was that I added to the lettuce crop that I planted spoke about last week. I added romaine lettuce and some Swiss chard.
Yeah. And we've had some good weather
for
that lettuce.
Yeah, and the butter crunch lettuce is thriving, and it's about doubled in size from where I planted it.
Yeah. I looked out the window at it out there in the boxes, and actually we walked out there yesterday too, and it all looks really healthy.
Yeah. Yeah, I went up to the garden center, and they had, when I got the butter crunch lettuce, they actually had some romaine, and I didn't get it, so I went back and I got some romaine.
You just couldn't resist.
Yeah, they had. Well, I wanted another variety.
Oh yeah.
But I like that cross pollination you get with. Yeah,
you know. There you go.
But
using them fancy terms.
The other thing, and I saw the Swiss chard, and it looked so nice. It looked so good.
Yeah.
That I went ahead and got a flat of that and planted it, and it pretty much filled the box up.
Yeah.
And I took a photograph of it and I put it on my Instagram account. And this lady wrote and asked me if that was beets, if I'd planted beets in there. And I said, oh, no, that's Swiss chard. But, you know, the green leafy leaves on it are look very much the same. As a matter of fact, if you get some beets, cut the top off of them, and you can cook them just like you would cook Swiss chard, and it tastes the same.
Yeah, and it would have to be very good for you because of all that red.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got a lot of polyphenols in it.
Yeah,
and,
polyphenols.
But that's some good stuff right there.
Yeah. But, anything else?
No, I guess that's about it. Run out of things to say. How about you? You
got? Yeah, no, I'm good. It was fun to go on a field trip. Yeah. It was really just interesting to see people out and about, and
a
lot of people with, you know, families and kids, and Cornbread took some good pictures. So I hope he's put some of those up on Instagram.
Yeah, I put a lot of them up on Instagram.
And, so you can see what we're talking about.
Yeah, a lot of the docents that were working there, I'd give me their emails and I'd send them a
copy. They seemed kind of suspicious at first, but.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't ask them for any money or anything.
Thanks so much, Cornbread. It's been a good
episode. Well, thank you, Buttermilk. It's been a wonderful, week. We've had some great weather and a
lot of honey.
Yeah, a lot of honey. What are we going to talk about next week? Do you know?
I think we're going to shift gears and maybe talk about something a little spicier. Talk about hot sauce.
Oh, hot sauce.
Hot. Mm, yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. I guess we got some homework to do then.
Yeah.
Well, everybody, we've really enjoyed going up to Helen and visiting the Hardman Farm. I guess you'd have to look online to see if they're having some activities there. But
they do have activities, and then I think they're open one day a week just as part of the Georgia Park system.
Yeah, yeah. I would check to make sure.
Oh, definitely.
If you were going specifically for that. But if you get up there and they're closed or something, you have a great time just going over to Helen and and always go by Betty's store and get you a sandwich and moon pie and RC Cola.
Well, and the Nora Mills is open, I think, every day except for Easter, Christmas, and New Year's Day.
That's true. And Nora Mills, one of the girls back in the back was making something to eat. You know, it smelled pretty good. I know she was doing grits to give people a sample of their grits.
Oh.
And so she was, I think she was making other stuff too.
I don't know how I missed that. I didn't see that.
She had like three skillets going back there.
Seriously? Yeah. Wow. I don't know. I was all excited about going outside to see the mill. So
yeah, Buttermilk went outside to, she wanted to run outside and look over the edge of the railing and see if she could see a trout. And she said, come here. And I had a jar of sourwood honey in my hand. And I didn't want to walk outside with it.
I thought we were going to take it. Yeah.
So I turned around and I asked her, I said, can I leave this honey here with you just for a minute while I step outside? She said, oh, yeah, yeah. So after we looked for trout, I said, well, let's go back in. I said, I got to pay for that honey I left in there. And we went back in and we ended up getting another jar.
It's Buttermilk, hard to resist. Yeah.
Buttermilk said, well, what'd you get? I said, oh, this is sourwood. And she said, well, this is wildflower. Why don't we get both and then we can compare them.
Interesting, too, when you hold them up to the light, the different, you know, the wildflower was a lot lighter in color.
Yeah. Yeah.
The sourwood was just so rich and that caramel brown color.
Anyway,
thank you so much.
We better go before we get started on another story here.
I know.
So next week, you know, we'll have plenty to talk about if we do our homework on hot sauces and what's available here in Georgia. I know we do have one company in Bethlehem, Georgia.
Yes.
That produces one of my favorite.
Well, let's not get started. Save it for next week.
All right. Come back next week and I'll tell you what my favorite is.
All right. Thank you, Cornbread.
Well, thank you, Buttermilk. And
all right, y'all take care. Thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, thank you for listening, and we love you all, and God bless you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Next time you're cooking shrimp and grits, tune in Edward Phillips on YouTube. Go to @ Edward Phillips Roots. That's @ Edward Phillips Roots. You'll enjoy his music. You'll enjoy the Delta blues played as you've never heard them played before.